أهلاً بكل الذين ينضموا للاستماع إلى راديو بلدي، أول راديو عربي أمريكي ويعنى بقضايا العرب في المهجر. برامجنا في راديو بلدي كل يوم جمعة من 8 وحتى 9 صباحاً مع ليلى الحسيني في بث حي ومباشر عبر WNZK Radio 690 AM. صباح الخير بلدي، صباح الخير لكل مستمعينا.
Welcome to Radio Baladi, the first Arab, Middle Eastern and American simulcast radio show. Radio Baladi is broadcast every Friday morning on WNZK 690 AM from 8 until 9 Eastern Time on Good Morning Michigan with Layla Al-Husseini. Our call-in number, 248-557-3300. And now, stay tuned for the best radio talk show on Arab and American issues with your host, Layla Al-Husseini.
This is Dr. Sahar Kamiz. Join me on the third Friday of each month at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'll be discussing some of the most important current political, economic, and social issues in my program, The Bridge. On Radio Baladi, on America's Voice of the Arabs, WNZK 690 AM, and WDMV 700 AM. Good morning, everyone. This is your host, Dr. Sahar Kamiz. Welcome to another great show on Radio Baladi on U.S. Arab Radio. Today, we're going to be talking about America and Islam, the journey of an author and his book. My guest today is distinguished author, journalist, writer, Dr. Lawrence Pintak. He is the author of the book America and Islam, Sound Bites, Suicide Bombs, and The Road to Donald Trump, which just came out in June 2019, published by Bloomsbury and IB Taurus. And he has 5 other books on the intersection between media and U.S. politics toward the Muslim world. He has more than 40 years experience covering the Middle East region and the Muslim world. He's a former CBS News Middle East correspondent and the former founding dean of the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication at Washington State University. He is also former director of the Kamal Adham Center for Television Journalism at the American University in Cairo, and he is now a non-resident senior scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. He holds a PhD in Islamic Studies. We can say that he's a hybrid journalist slash author, a journalist turned into an academic, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot of interesting topics and subjects to cover with him today. Welcome to the show, Dr. Pintak.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure having you with us today. Before we delve into talking about your book, America and Islam, as the title of the show today suggests, we're going to talk also about the journey that got you to this point and to writing this book. If you can just start by giving our listeners an idea, what really triggered your interest in covering the Middle East and the Muslim world to start with?
Well, I'm one of those strange people who very early on in life knew what he wanted to do, and that was in high school in the U.S. I watched one night, I was watching the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite at that point, and saw the then Middle East correspondent, Dean Braless, doing a stand-up on the Golan Heights, and I said, that's the job I want. And I was lucky enough to, you know, within 3 years of graduating college, have that job as CBS Middle East correspondent. After that, I spent years in the Middle East, and then I left the Middle East eventually, spent 5 years in Indonesia, where I met my wife and my kids were all born, back to the States, and then I decided to make a transition into academia. My wife had always said, you really ought to end up in academia. So I tested the waters in a visiting chair at the University of Michigan for 2 years, and during that second year, I got a call from a mutual colleague of ours, yours and mine, Abdullah Schleifer, who was then at the American University in Cairo and had founded the Adham Center for Television Journalism. And he said he was retiring and they were looking for someone else to take over, and they wanted ideally someone who had deep knowledge of the Middle East as a TV correspondent and had some academic background. And so, to make a long story short, ultimately I accepted the job and went out to Cairo and spent 5 years there and back to the States. And since then, I'm back and forth to the region basically every couple of months.
Correct. I know that you're bouncing back and forth in so many travels and journeys between the West and the East, and we'll talk about that also. But, you know, you mentioned your wife is from Indonesia, and I know this fact. If you can just tell our listeners briefly, like, this experience of marrying someone from Indonesia, getting exposed to this part of the Muslim world, Indonesia being, of course, the largest Muslim country in the world, what did this possibly add in terms of your own nuance in understanding the Muslim world, or having a different lens maybe from many Westerners when they look at the so-called quote-unquote Muslim world?
Oh, I think it, as you said, it gives me the nuance. It helps me, certainly living in the Arab world and covering the Arab world, I never subscribed to that Western perception of the Muslim monolith. Obviously, there are countless different approaches to Islam, different schools of Islam, etc. But go from the Arab world to a place like Indonesia, and again, you have a very different approach to the religion. The way that, you know, the cliche about Indonesian Islam is it's the gentle face of Islam. And by that, people mean that it is a very, and not to imply that Islam is not tolerant, but it is a very tolerant version of Islam, in that Indonesian Islam traditionally has a lot of local animist beliefs woven into it. It has some aspects of Buddhism woven into it. It's a very mystical approach to Islam. And of course, many Indonesian Muslims are Sufis, so, you know, you start with that mystic approach. And then you layer on the very real mysticism of the animist belief systems in Indonesia, and so it really is another face of Islam.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think this is really something that adds to the richness of your own journey, both as a scholar, as a writer and author, as well as, of course, a journalist covering the region for so many years. One theme that runs across all your books, and as I mentioned in my introduction, you do have a number of other books. We will talk about them just briefly now. One theme that runs across all of these books is really the stereotypes about Islam and Muslims and the role of the media in terms of creating some of these possibly negative stereotypes or sometimes misperceptions that spill over into shaping U.S. policy towards the Muslim world. So you published previously the book, The New Arab Journalist, Mission and Identity in a Time of Turmoil. Another book is Reflections in a Bloodshot Lens, America, Islam, and the War of Ideas. You also published Seeds of Hate, How America's Flawed Middle East Policy Ignited the Jihad, and also Islam for Journalists and, between brackets, everyone else. So if you can just tell our listeners, like, you know, in a snapshot, I know this is hard to do about when you wrote all of these books, but this theme of the role of the media and how it shapes the U.S. policy, if you can just tell us why this really inspired you to write these books and what are the most important takeaways?
Well, I think it's because Americans tend to look at the world, not just Islam, in very black and white terms, good guys and bad guys. And that's particularly true of the Arab world, and it's particularly true of the conflicts in the Arab world. And I think this was first driven home to me in Lebanon, which, you know, I was based in Beirut in the early 80s during the American intervention, the Israeli invasion, and then the Western intervention, which ultimately descended into the conflict with America's first modern conflict with Islam, the war against the Druzes and the Shia in Lebanon. And that war, that American policy, was shaped by this black and white perspective. To Ronald Reagan, there were good guys and bad guys in Lebanon. There were the people who wore the white hats and the people who wore the black hats. And of course, you know, most of your listeners will know that Lebanon, I actually thought of titling one of my early books about Lebanon, Shades of Gray, because there are ultimately no good guys and no bad guys. Everyone has, you know, some blood on their hands. Everyone has some responsibility for the turmoil there. And America's fundamental mistake was taking the sides of the, quote, legitimate government, which was the Christians, against the rest. And that led to where we are today, because that was what sparked the first suicide bombings against the embassy, against the Marine barracks. And so nothing has changed as we moved forward through various American administrations. It's always that same black and white. We saw it in Iraq. We see it in Yemen. We see it in Syria. And so much of that is driven by the media, by how we journalists cover the region.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We'll come back to this very important discussion right after this commercial break. Stay tuned, please.
If halal is important to your family, you can trust that Miramar will offer not only the highest quality halal products, but the best tasting and healthiest foods that can be placed on your family table with confidence. Miramar is the first and oldest halal certified food brand in America, serving the Arab and Muslim community, and offers a wide range of halal food products. Check out Miramar's halal food selection today by visiting Miramar's exclusive distributor, Ziad Brothers Importing, at www.ziad.com.
The Rama Relief Foundation provides humanitarian aid into areas inside of war-torn Syria, as well as aid to the refugees who have fled to the neighboring countries in the Middle East. The foundation offers food baskets, container shipment, mental health, education, soup kitchens, and more. Go to ramarelief.org or call 248-990-4247. Any donation amount made to Rama will go to sustaining many lives. Call now 248-990-4247.
تعرفوا شيء؟ احنا كتير منهتم بالمقبلات بالأكل الشامي،
واحنا منهتم بالبهارات والتسبيكة في الأكل المصري،
واحنا نهتم هواية باللحوم وجودتها بالأكل العراقي، واحنا في مطعم عشتار نهتم بيكم، اعتمدوا علينا. أيا كان، نحن في عشتار نعرف أن لكل مذاق أسرار، فنحن نقدم أجود أنواع اللحوم من ملحمة عشتار الواقعة على 56865 راين رود.
عشتار، قصة حضارة ترويها لكم أطباقنا المميزة في كل زيارة.
تفضلوا بزيارتنا في 3625 East 50 Mile Road Stanley Heights.
مطعم عشتار بإدارة فادي بهنام وعلي البغدادي.
586-698-2585. When you're looking for the best in optical care, Dr. Imad Nakash is your doctor to see. With years of experience and thousands of successful procedures performed, you can trust your eyes to Dr. Imad Nakash. See Dr. Imad Nakash and his professional staff for your eye care needs. There's two locations to serve you. In Hazel Park, call 248-336-3937. 248-336-3937. In Rochester Hills, call 248-299-3937. That's 248-299-3937.
Life is a nonprofit charity that's provided humanitarian aid and development to people and communities for over 25 years, regardless of race, color, religion, or cultural background. When disaster occurs here or around the world, Life for Relief and Development rushes in to provide food, medical aid, and shelter to those in need. Please help improve these efforts. Make your tax-deductible donation to Life now at lifeusa.org or call 248-424-7493.
This is Dr. Sahar Kamis. Join me on the third Friday of each month at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'll be discussing some of the most important current political, economic, and social issues in my program, The Bridge, on Radio Baladi, on America's Voice of the Arabs, WNZK 690 AM and WDMV 700 AM. Welcome back to the show, everyone. This is your host, Dr. Sahar Kamis, and with me today is distinguished author, writer, scholar, and journalist, Dr. Lawrence Pintek, discussing his latest book, America and Islam, Soundbites, Suicide Bombs, and the Road to Donald Trump, that just came out in June 2019. Right before the break, we were talking about the role of the media in shaping the image about Islam and Muslims, and also the policy, U.S. policy. But we're living in now very different times. I was giving a talk yesterday to the MSA, the Muslim Student Association, at the University of Maryland. I told them these are very challenging times to be a Muslim, but they're also very rewarding times to be a Muslim. If you can just comment a little bit on, from your perspective, some of the challenges facing Muslims in general and American Muslims in particular at this moment, and maybe some of the best ways to tackle them?
Well, I don't need to tell you or your audience that since 9/11 in particular, things have been difficult for American Muslims. But certainly since the election campaign, things have become terrible in many ways. Obviously, Donald Trump brought an overtly anti-Muslim, Islamophobic narrative to the campaign, and through his actions ever since, nothing has changed. And you can argue it's only gotten worse. However, there has been a reverse reaction as well. American Muslims now are more energized, more politically engaged, more active than at any time in history. American Muslims, first and foremost, were never of one party. You found many Republican Muslims and many Democratic Muslims. And now most American Muslims are anti-Trump, but more importantly, they are engaged in the political process. So in the midterm elections in 2018, we, a separate project I have going, we counted 166 American Muslims who ran for office. That was a staggering number. We'd never seen anything like that. And obviously, two were elected to Congress. Many others were elected to state legislatures, about 50 city councils, boards of education, and more are now gearing up for 2020. So that is a very positive reaction to what has happened.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We can see that, you know, there's some light coming out of this darkness. And we actually saw solidarity as well across the board from non-Muslims from all different demographic backgrounds and racial, ethnic, religious backgrounds, standing in solidarity with the American Muslim community. But one thing which is very important here that you mentioned is political engagement. And you said, you know, you had this study, ongoing study. What were the most important themes or threads or findings maybe that you can share, you know, so far with our listeners pertaining to the importance and significance of the study and the results it revealed?
Well, this is a study that will come out later this month from the Social Science Research Council. We examined, first of all, we surveyed many of those who were running for office, asking them about their encounters with Islamophobia on the campaign trail. And the positive is that their encounters were relatively little. Some were certainly facing death threats and really ugly online and verbal attacks. People like Deidre Abood, who ran for Senate in Arizona. But for the most part, those were isolated incidents. For the most part, Islamophobia did not drive the narrative of the campaign. If you go online, however, it does. And this is the big difference. Online, you have this cabal of Islamophobes who drive an anti-Muslim agenda. So when we looked at the Twitter feeds or the Twitter networks around Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, we found vast levels of Islamophobia. But all of it traced back to a handful of individuals. So you have these agents provocateurs who are operating online, riling up people. But that isn't necessarily happening in the districts where Muslims are running.
I want to go back again to the media. You know, both of us are in the field of media, obviously, for so many years. And the media of the past is not the media of the present, and obviously not the media of the future. When we talk about the media today, you have the mainstream media, which is controlled by obviously certain powers and entities and authorities. But you also just pointed out to the social media domain, which I believe has been shaping a lot of the images and stereotypes, like you just mentioned some examples of Islamophobic campaigns. How are we seeing this role of the media changing and evolving now as we speak in terms of shaping these perceptions and misperceptions and stereotypes, and how can it possibly play a different role if we use it differently?
Well, it's interesting. Let me give you some Arab context, and that is back when Al Jazeera was founded in 1995, that changed the narrative in the Arab world. Up until then, Arabs were seeing events in their own region through the prism of the Western media. So there was no, other than the government-run TV stations, there were no other TV stations they could turn to. So they turned to Western media. With the arrival of Al Jazeera and then Al Arabiya and others, it meant that suddenly Arabs were seeing their region covered through the prism of an Arab camera. And that changed the narrative completely during the Iraq invasion. And so it meant Americans were seeing one war and Arabs were seeing a completely different war. Well, fast forward to now, and we have this happening domestically in the U.S., in the Arab world, in South Asia, anywhere you look, because those divisions, those different prisms of media are now existing in every country. Here in the U.S., we have an incredibly divided media, and politically and ideologically, and we all tend to look at the media that supports our preconceived notions. So we have gotten to a point where we can no longer have a rational policy debate because we no longer agree on basic facts. When I was young and the Vietnam War was on and America was divided over Richard Nixon, everyone would have big arguments over dinner tables, generational arguments about this. But we all agreed that we were in Vietnam. Whether we agreed we should be there or not, we agreed we were there. We agreed with the basic fact that Richard Nixon was president, whether we wanted him to be or not. Now we don't have agree on those basic facts. We can't agree on whether the sky is green or orange. And so there is so little room for a conversation.
Absolutely. The degree of polarization has really increased tremendously, and I would say even became toxic. But before we leave this theme of the media and go for a break, just quickly, I think that we do need more, quote-unquote, Muslims speaking for themselves and about themselves in the media. Up till this moment in time, we do not have enough, American Muslim anchor women, anchor men, presenters, writers, journalists. What can we do possibly in order to encourage more of our young people to go into the field and to become also professionals in the field of media? Because I believe this is very important. If you don't tell the story in your own words, someone else will tell it instead of you, and it's not going to get it. They're not going to get it in most cases right. So, what would be some of your tips?
You're absolutely right. I mean, obviously, encouraging them to study journalism, to go into the media. But I will say that this is light years away from where we were even a decade ago. You didn't see American Muslims or any Muslims in the media in front of the camera or the byline in the New York Times, etc. I mean, you only have to go back to Nora Bustani of the Washington Post. It was really the first Muslim that turned up, or Arab, that turned up in the American media writing for the American media. When I was covering Beirut, Nora was an assistant for the New York Times correspondent. She didn't write articles, or she didn't have her byline in the paper. And American television wouldn't even put someone with a British accent on TV, much less an Arab or an Indonesian or an Indian, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. So that is dramatically different. Now, you know, you look at the Post, you look at the Times, you look at CNN, you look at CBS, you do see Arabs. MSNBC, Ayman Mohyeddin just got a promotion to a new high-profile show on MSNBC. So they are moving into the media in a very big way. Would it be good that there is more? Absolutely. That is true of every minority group.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We'll come back to this very interesting discussion right after this commercial break. Stay tuned, please.
When it comes to reproductive medicine, IVF Michigan Fertility Centers are the recognized leaders. With locations in Bloomfield Hills and 5 other cities in Michigan and Ohio, IVF has experts in all aspects of the field. As a founding member of IVF Michigan Fertility Centers, Dr. Nicholas Shama is one of the leading reproductive endocrinologists in Michigan and Ohio. Dr. Shama has performed over 10,000 IVF cases and has helped thousands of couples fulfill their dreams of parenthood. American Board certified in both obstetrics and gynecology and reproductive endocrinology and infertility, Dr. Nicholas Shama is a very caring, compassionate, expert physician that understands not only the medical but also the emotional toil of infertility on his patients. When it's time, get personalized care from Dr. Nicholas Shama at IVF Michigan Fertility Centers in Michigan and Ohio. Call toll-free 855-952-9600, 855-952-9600.
تعرفوا شيء؟ احنا كتير منهتم بالمقبلات بالأكل الشامي.
وإحنا بنهتم بالبهارات والتسبيكة في الأكل المصري.
وإحنا نهتم هواية باللحوم وجودتها بالأكل العراقي. وإحنا في مطعم عشتار نهتم بيكم. اعتمدوا علينا. أيا كان نحن في عشتار نعرف أن لكل مذاق أسرار. فنحن نقدم أجود أنواع اللحوم من ملحمة عشتار الواقعة على 56865 راين رود.
عشتار قصة حضارة ترويها لكم أطباقنا المميزة في كل زيارة.
تفضلوا بزيارتنا في 3625 East 50 Mile Road Stanley.
مطعم عشتار بإدارة فادي بهنام وعلي البغدادي 586-698-2585 586-698-2585.
Life is a non-profit charity that's provided humanitarian aid and development to people and communities for over 25 years, regardless of race, color, religion, or cultural background. When disaster occurs here or around the world, Life for Relief and Development rushes in to provide food, medical aid, and shelter to those in need. Please help improve these efforts. Make your tax-deductible donation to Life now at lifeusa.org or call 248-424-7493.
Kashat's Mediterranean Market and Shish Kebab offers a great array of your favorite Mediterranean meals. Meals range from lamb specialties, shawarma sandwiches, seafood dinners, and they offer special big trays of your favorite food, plus much more. Kashat's Mediterranean Market and Shish Kebab address is 32839 Northwestern Highway in Farmington Hills. Their phone number is 248-538-9552. That number again is 248-538-9552, and the supermarket is open from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Kashat's Mediterranean Market and Shish Kebab will definitely leave you satisfied.
This is Dr. Sahar Kamis. Join me on the third Friday of each month at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'll be discussing some of the most important current political, economic, and social issues in my program, The Bridge, on Radio Baladi, on America's Voice of the Arabs, WNZK 690 AM and WDMV 700 AM. Welcome back to the show, everyone. This is your host, Dr. Sahar Kamis, and we're talking today to Dr. Lawrence Pintek, a distinguished author, writer, scholar, and journalist who authored the book America and Islam, Sound Bites, Suicide Bombs, and the Road to Donald Trump, that just came out in June 2019. So now let's focus on this book that really got endorsements and from a number of very distinguished scholars and also media people like Dan Rather, former anchor at CBS, and Ryan Crocker, former U.S. ambassador and CNN chief international correspondent, Clarissa Ward, Mark Lynch of George Washington University, and Philip Seep of University of Southern California. Very impressive. Every book is a journey, and writing a book is a journey. So I want to know from you, and I want our listeners to know, how did this journey of writing this particular book start, and how did it shift or change along the way?
Absolutely. I was, as you mentioned earlier, I was the founding dean at the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication here at Washington State University. Now, I'd been dean for about 6.5 years as we went into the primaries, and I was listening to the horrible Islamophobic rhetoric of the primaries, and I said to myself, I need to do another book. I can't allow this period to pass without doing a book about it. So I stepped down as dean. I was ready for a break anyway. Stepped down as dean, but I set out to do a book that was forward-looking. My intent was to do a book that looked at the damage being done by the campaign, both domestically in relations with American Muslims and internationally in terms of relations with Muslims around the world. And so that's the book I set out to do. And then Donald Trump won. And I said, oh, my God, I can't do a forward-looking book of where do we go from here, how do we fix the damage, because he's president now. And so do I wait for 4 years? Well, what if he gets, first of all, that's too long. And what if he gets reelected? I don't have that kind of patience. So I really struggled for about 3 or 4 months trying to figure out the new vision of the book. And then I realized that Donald Trump is not an aberration. He is a product of where we have been and where we've been going. And while his Islamophobic rhetoric is obviously blatant and raw and vile, we've had Islamophobia in America since before the revolution. We have had presidents who looked at the Muslim world as a monolith. You know, certainly since Ronald Reagan went into Lebanon, or when we stayed, we helped foment the coup in Iran in the 50s. So, so that's the book I set out to do. So I document the impact that he had on domestic American Muslims. I profile the city of Portland, Oregon, which is a big Muslim population, but has also been racked by both actual terrorism cases and alleged terrorism cases. I look at how American Muslims recouped from the election. I look at the first year of Trump and the relationship with Saudi and Iran and perspectives around the world, and ultimately get to where are we going.
Absolutely. If I was to ask you about some of the lines of continuation, you know, overlap, divergence, in other words, similarities and differences between this latest book and your previous books that we mentioned previously, what are some of the themes that you saw somehow, you know, overlapping or intersecting between these different books? And what are some of the things that you exclusively bring differently to this latest book?
Interesting question. I think this book and two of my earlier books, The Seeds of Hate, which is built around the American engagement in Lebanon and then shows how that influenced ultimately the rise of Al-Qaeda and terrorism, The Reflections in a Bloodshot Lens, America, Islam, and the War of Ideas, which is about the Iraq War and the media perspectives around that. Those two and this book all follow this theme of this disconnect between America and the Muslim world, this disconnect between the perspectives, the worldview of so many Americans and those of the rest of the world. How we see, we Americans and people in the Middle East and the broader Muslim world, see development so differently. You know, the Iraq War, for Americans, it was overthrowing a dictator. For many Arabs, it was an invasion, a colonial invasion. So this book follows those themes, but one of the things that I do through the book is attack head-on these various cliches and stereotypes. So there's a chapter about the fact that Islam is not a monolith. You know, Donald Trump said Islam hates us. Well, obviously there is no Islam that hates anyone or anything, because Islam is a panoply of people and ideas and perspectives. And so I look at, through an entire chapter, the divisions within Islam, the fact that, you know, from the death of the Prophet Muhammad, Islam essentially descended into civil war. The first divisions came out then, and nothing has changed. Things have gotten even more divided. So, and I'm not saying this in a negative way, but I'm saying that this underscores the fact that Islam is not a monolith.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think that's one of the most important takeaways that one can get from reading this book, is this kind of diversity and pluralism under the umbrella of quote-unquote Islam. You also talk in the book about the concept of quote-unquote the American Taliban, which is interesting because recently we've been seeing, you know, Taliban-US talks and negotiations. God knows if this is going to succeed. You know, there's so many question marks over there and about this particular issue. But if you want to talk a little bit about this particular concept as it came through in your book to our listeners, and just tell them a little bit about this concept of American Taliban.
Sure. This was a line from someone in Pakistan, and I spent a lot of time there these days. I literally just came back 3 days ago. I talked to a lot of people, particularly early on in the primaries, about perspectives of Trump. And I thought it all was summed up by a member. The guy at the time was the head of the Ulama Council in Pakistan, but he's a very hardline cleric. He had fought in Afghanistan against the Americans, not just against the Russians, but against the Americans. He had called for suicide bombings against American troops, etc. And he's a big, rotund guy, about 300 pounds, big, wild beard. And I said to him, so what do you think of Donald Trump? And he reared back, and he broke into this deep laugh, and he said, he doesn't belong in the White House. he belongs in a mental asylum. And that pretty much summed up the view of many Pakistanis.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I'm sure that, you know, listeners who are interested definitely should read the book and get more sense of these particular very interesting themes. Another very interesting theme I personally found was this concept or notion of, quote-unquote, the Americanization of Islam, or what we call in Arabic, al-Islam al-Ameriki. And some people look at this concept really in different ways. Some people look at it very favorably, while others obviously look at it very critically, or even sometimes skeptically. They look at it with skepticism, with criticism. You know, they're like, what is this Americanization of Islam? If you want to tell our listeners just a glimpse of what you really tackled in this whole notion of Americanization of Islam, and what did you find?
Absolutely. What I found was that Islam is changing in America, but that doesn't mean that the core beliefs of Islam are changing. As every Muslim knows, so much of the, shall I use the word, packaging of Islam is cultural. Right down to the arguments over whether, you know, you're a hijabi, those arguments over whether the hijab is mandated by the Quran or whether it's a cultural accoutrement. And with Islam in America, for years, you go into any mosque in America, and the mullahs are, the clerics are Egyptians, they're Pakistanis, they're Indian Muslims, Indonesians, etc. They have just come to the country, and they bring with them all of their cultural baggage, and quite often don't connect very well with American Muslims. And we see this in mosque attendance, right, around the country. Many American Muslims consider themselves good Muslims, but don't particularly go to the mosque because they find that what they're hearing in the mosque really doesn't resonate with them. But what we have now is an entire generation of Americans who have been trained as clerics, Sunni, Shia, whatever you want to discuss, have been in Saudi Arabia studying, have been in Iran studying, and have come back, and they have brought with them their knowledge of Islam, but their American culture. They either were born here, or they came in as children, and so were raised as Americans. And that brings a very different approach to what they tell their flock, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We'll come back to this very interesting discussion right after this commercial break. Stay tuned, please.
If halal is important to your family, you can trust that Miramar will offer not only the highest quality halal products, but the best tasting and healthiest foods that can be placed on your family table with confidence. Miramar is the first and oldest halal certified food brand in America, serving the Arab and Muslim community, and offers a wide range of halal food products. Check out Miramar's halal food selection today by visiting Miramar's exclusive distributor, Ziad Brothers Importing, at www.ziad.com.
The Rama Relief Foundation provides humanitarian aid into areas inside of war-torn Syria, as well as aid to the refugees who have fled to the neighboring countries in the Middle East. The foundation offers food baskets, container shipment, mental health, education, soup kitchens, and more. Go to ramarelief.org or call 248-990-4247. Any donation amount made to Rama will go to sustaining many lives. Call now 248-990-4247.
تعرف شيء؟ احنا كتير بنهتم بالمقبلات بالأكل الشامي،
واحنا بنهتم بالبهارات والتسبيكة في الأكل المصري،
واحنا نهتم هواية باللحوم وجودتها بالأكل العراقي، واحنا في مطعم عشتار نهتم بيكم، اعتمدوا علينا. أيا كان، نحن في عشتار نعرف أن لكل مذاق أسرار، فنحن نقدم أجود أنواع اللحوم من ملحمة عشتار الواقعة على 56865 راين رود.
عشتار، قصة حضارة ترويها لكم أطباقنا المميزة في كل زيارة.
تفضلوا بزيارتنا في 3625 East 50 Mile Road Stanley Heights.
مطعم عشتار بإدارة فادي بهنام وعلي البغدادي. 586-698-2585. 586-698-2585.
Are you going to start a restaurant or a grocery store soon? Do you need floor plans and designs? Call Najee Abood at 734-744-9796. Do you want to buy kitchen and restaurant equipment at discount prices? Call Najee Abood now, 734-744-9796. New Concept Products and Design, the trademark of kitchen equipment. 5% discount on all purchases of $75,000 or more. New concept products and design. New location, 31185 Schoolcraft in Livonia. Learn more at www.newconceptproducts.com. Call Najee Abood, 734-744-9796.
This is Dr. Sahar Kamis. Join me on the third Friday of each month at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'll be discussing some of the most important current political, economic, and social issues in my program, The Bridge. On Radio Baladi, on America's Voice of the Arabs, WNZK 690 AM and WDMV 700 AM. Welcome back to the show, everyone. This is your host, Dr. Sahar Kamis. And with me this morning is a distinguished writer, author, scholar, and journalist, Dr. Lawrence Pintak, discussing his latest book, America and Islam, Sound Bites, Suicide Bombs, and the Road to Donald Trump, that was just published in June 2019. I would definitely say that you're bringing your lens, both literally and metaphorically as well, to your books in terms of how you are looking at the issues and tackling them as a hybrid journalist slash scholar, or maybe I should say a journalist turned into a scholar or an academic. So basically, your latest book, I see a lot of field work interviews being conducted in different places with different people. If you can just give our listeners a brief idea or a glimpse of when, where, and with whom some of these interviews were conducted, and what were some of the most important takeaways, the things that really stunned you as a person writing this book?
Well, I joke that I'm a journalist masquerading as a scholar, because once a journalist, always a journalist, and certainly that is something that I bring to my books. I don't believe in you know, ivory tower pontificating. I like to be out in the field talking to people, gathering firsthand information, not necessarily in a, you know, an organized survey, et cetera, but reporting, gathering, you know, talking to people, finding out what's really happening. So, yeah, I reported this book from, oh, goodness, I don't know, 5, 6, 8 countries, something like that, various Middle East countries in the Middle East, South Asia, and, you know, around the U.S., and talked to everyone from top officials in places like Pakistan or Dubai, to ordinary people on the street, to a cross-section of American Muslims, top Muslim leaders, top Muslim scholars, and lots of ordinary Americans, lots of people who are heading mosques in various parts of the country, people who are online clerics with a million followers or more. And I spent a fair amount of time down in Portland, Oregon, which I used as a microcosm of Islam in America. Because Portland, unlike, you know, Dearborn, Michigan, is Arab. Minneapolis is largely Somali. Portland is a very, very homogeneous Muslim community with everyone from, you know, your standard issue Arabs and South Asians, etc., but Uyghurs and Bosnians, etc. And it was also battered by, it had the first case of actual domestic terrorism, the Portland Seven, and then it had a number of people who were accused of terrorism just through 3 degrees of separation from Al-Qaeda. They knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody who knew bin Laden. So it was a very interesting place, and I really got to know the people down there very well.
Absolutely. And maybe that's really one of the values of being a former journalist, like, you know, basically, you know, this whole technique of data collection from a very large number of people, but not just based on, as you said, surveys, but actual people in real life situations, which is very interesting. One chapter that really, really caught my attention in the book is the chapter titled How the West Created Radical Islam. It is no secret that so many Muslims talk about this whole idea of, you know, what could be the Western slash American responsibility for creation of radical groups like, for example, ISIS, or before that, Al-Qaeda. So would you like to just touch upon this very important and very contentious theme, please?
Sure. This is not to say that they would not have been radicals. But many Western actions created a backlash that created radicalism. And you go all the way back, and you notice I say Western, not just American, because you go all the way back to the period after World War One, when, you know, many Arabs know that the Hashemites supported the Allies against the Turks, against the Ottoman Empire during the war. And the House of Saud just sat it out, basically, had no involvement. And the Hashemites did this because they thought they were essentially going to get the caliphate, and that was basically what the Brits had told them. Well, at the end, the Brits didn't want to do that because they wanted to preserve their oil interest in Iraq, and so they unleashed the House of Saud against the Hashemites, and in doing that, they fueled the rise and the activity of the Ikhwan, the original Ikhwan, who were they were the equivalent back then of ISIS. The extreme hardliners, and they basically wiped out, you know, the Hashemites drove them out of Saudi Arabia, what's now Saudi Arabia. And then you have a direct line from those Ikhwan to the Ikhwan, literally bloodlines, who took over the Grand Mosque in 1979. It was literally the son and grandson of Ikhwan leaders. And that then sparked the right turn in Saudi Arabia back to a very fundamentalist approach. And again, then you don't have to go far to follow those lines to Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I met one person, he was the author of a book called Visas for Al-Qaeda, and he was talking about, you know, how there was this whole notion of some fighters who got away with getting visas actually to travel to Afghanistan and later on became members or founders of Al-Qaeda. So there's so many different, of course, complicated and tangled aspects to these phenomena, as I'm sure you know, and our listeners also can read more about this concept and read more about it in your book and elsewhere. But there's definitely a lot of complex factors at play right here. Another concept that really caught my attention also in the book is your discussion about this notion or concept of quote-unquote cognitive dissonance. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that? Where did you find this cognitive dissonance to be most prevailing and why?
Well, I found it prevailing in my head one day when I had spent a couple of weeks in Pakistan and then the Emirates. And I got on, there's a direct Emirates flight from Dubai to Seattle, and I live in Washington State. And so I took this flight, and I landed at 7 in the morning. And at 7 that night, I was at a Donald Trump campaign rally outside Seattle. And so having spent a couple of weeks listening to Arabs and Pakistanis and others talk about Donald Trump and their perspectives on this horror show that was happening in the U.S., suddenly I was there in the arena with him, hearing his comments about Arabs and Muslims and the comments of the people who were there to hear him.
Very interesting. And I'm sure we're seeing a lot of this cognitive dissonance prevailing day in and day out, you know, with all as well the polarization in the media and all the different, you know, discourses and rhetorics that we are hearing every single day from many, many different sources, oftentimes telling us different stories and different narratives. The writing of a book, as much as it's a journey, we talked about the journey that made you write the book, there is always what I call the lamenting moment after writing a book. Like, you know, having written books myself, there's always this feeling of like, oh, I wish I had tackled this particular point, you know, I wish I had talked about this, or I wish I had done this differently. What are some of the things that maybe now, looking back, since the baby is born, the book is out, it's published, people can read it, that you as an author look and say, oh, I wish I had included this particular theme, or I wish I had done this differently?
You know, it's interesting you say that. I actually don't, and I don't want to make this sound wrong, but I don't have that feeling about this book. I feel like it covered the kind of broad range of topics that I wanted to dig into. And I think the challenge with this book was where to end it. And I don't have any regrets about where I ended it, but it was a challenge because, again, going back to the fact that, you know, I set out to do a book that was going to be about the damage of the campaign and then looking forward what next, and then Trump got into office. Well, as I was writing the book and he was now in office, I kept saying, well, I'm going to stop it here. but then he'd do something else, or I'll stop it there. And so then I got to the point where I just have to stop writing this book, because otherwise I'm going to keep adding to it and adding to it. And so it is not a, you know, the end all, the last word on Donald Trump and Islam, but I think it gives a pretty good perspective on the issues. No matter what he does tomorrow, we get the sense of why he's doing that from this book.
Great. And since you said there's no ending, you know, there's always like this point of like, you're always working on something new and you're always trying to add something else, maybe not in the same book, because then the book will never end. Just like we say to our students, our doctoral students at the university, the best dissertation is a finished dissertation. So you can also say the best book is the finished book. You need to stop somewhere. But I'm sure your journey...
Well, absolutely. And the other, if I can jump in, Sahar, the other thing is, you know, I have the advantage that because I'm, you know, as you said, a hybrid, I'm always writing articles. You know, so this week when you and I are talking, I had one piece on Axios about Kashmir, another piece on the Middle East Institute website, a long interview I did with the president of Pakistani Kashmir, and then, you know, talk about stories never ending, I have a piece on Vox.com about the death of Robert Mugabe, and talking about the fact that back in 1978, he and I met, and he talked about how he was not going to make the same mistakes the rest of Black Africa made. And in the end, of course, he perfected the brutality and horror of the rest of Black Africa. So stories never end. But if you have the advantage of being able to be constantly writing about things, you have that outlet.
Absolutely. That's great that you're writing for mainstream media and you're writing for different outlets as well. I also want to know, what are some of your current and future projects? I'm sure there are going to be other books. We have 5 minutes left, but I really want to give our listeners an idea or a glimpse of what you are working on right now and what you are planning to work on in the future, maybe another new book.
Well, I mean, there'll always be a book in the works or a couple of books in the works. We mentioned before this big study that I have coming out later this month on Islamophobia in the 2018 elections. And there's other things we're going to do around that. And then I'm working on something that's completely different from all of these other books. And that is a book on spiritualism, on profiling individuals who've gone down in a very big way, have gone down a spiritual path. So I have a magazine article that I just finished that'll be a chapter in the book on an American who I know who is a Sufi who ended up, unbeknownst to me, I just learned, you know, within 6 months, that he is one of the leading leaders of Sufism in Turkey. Several of the major, the Medlevis and several of the other major Sufi schools. And so I'm fascinated by this idea of ordinary people, not, you know, interviewing the Dalai Lama, et cetera, but ordinary people who've gone deep into a spiritual path and what they learn about it.
I'm so glad that you're tackling this particular point, because I think spirituality has been like really something that has not been talked about or discussed sufficiently. And unfortunately, we've been talking a lot about Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Al-ISIS, and ISIS, because that's what has been dominating the news and the mainstream media. So I'm so happy that you're really focusing on spirituality in your next projects. And I would definitely love to see a book coming out soon on this particular theme. Can you finally tell our listeners like where they can find the book, like American Islam, they can find it online, where they can possibly get it if they're interested in obtaining it, please?
Sure. I mean, it's available through all major bookstores. You know, if you walk in and it's not on the shelves, you can ask them to order it. It's obviously available on Amazon and Barnes and Noble, etc., both in hard copy and digital. And that's true around the world. As I said, I just got back from Pakistan, and it's in some of the bookstores in Pakistan, because Bloomsbury is a global publisher, so they're distributing everywhere. But also for your audience in the Middle East, I know that often you aren't able to get a Kindle version from Amazon. But Bloomsbury has a digital version of the book that is available directly from Bloomsbury.com. You can buy it there and download it immediately, even if you don't have Kindle, etc.
Excellent. That's very helpful. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be interested in reading this book, American Islam, Sound Bites, Suicide Bombs, and the Road to Donald Trump by Dr. Lawrence Pintak. Congratulations on your book and your so many achievements over the years. I definitely look forward to even more and more achievements and more books coming out soon.
Thank you, Sahar. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for being with us today. It has been really a pleasure. We hope to have you back again with us at US Arab Radio for another discussion, possibly on your new books and your new projects. And I would like to take the opportunity to thank our listeners. Thank you all so much for being with us today and following our discussion. Thank you and have a great day. Goodbye.